Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. This is going to be an empowering hour. Lots of good information, positive information. I'm going to spend more time today doing a little classroom on the air like I did with Taurine the other day, but on green tea. It serves so many healing purposes in the body, and I'm going to thank Bill Falloon at Life Extension because he did the original research. And I reconfirmed all that, read the studies. So we have a lot to share about green tea. Also, from Chris Hedges, The World to Come from TruthDig. And I'm working on a new article. I'm going to present it on our next program. I will be here on New Year's Day to show how we can start our life over, no matter what our circumstances, our age, no matter what our current disposition. We can change, and we should, because we deserve a happier, healthier life. And so I'll be sharing some points of view on that. Also, later today, Richard Gale will be joining me because I'm going to start the process of what the media has not done. And that's disappointing because when I first came to New York City in the mid-1960s, it was such an exciting experience for someone who was young, naive, not worldly in any sense. And I was humbled by how smart people were. And I was fortunate enough to live just in a tiny little one-room apartment, but it was a block away from the New Yorker bookstore. Downstairs was the New Yorker Theater at 89th and Broadway. And upstairs was a bookstore with all these couches and these grizzled, wiser, older, mainly men. Occasionally, I would see a woman, 95% men, and these were Marxist, communist people, Trotskyites, all the different political philosophies. And they would have arguments and debates. And of course, I knew nothing, so I just sat there in a chair and listened to them. But at least I saw that there was a place where people would entertain different points of view. Now, I'm not a supporter of Marx, of communism. I think Karl Marx made a lot of important points, some of what I could accept from him, other of his philosophy I would let go. But I look at what is true in any philosophy and then try to bring that in. It's like a religious studies. If I had my way, we would take the Old Testament, New Testament, all the religious books, and take everything in it that is that dehumanizes, misogynist, hate-filled, slavery, anything at all that is negative, and take them out and just leave the best information to be inspired by, because I think that's what we do, because if we're inspired by something that's toxic and negative, it reinforces it. If we're inspired by something positive and healing, then it motivates us. Either way, we're going to do something. And I want us to do something that's better than what we've done in the past to help heal our past, heal our indiscretions, heal our infirmaries, heal our limitations, to heal us at a level at the spirit. When we do that, then we don't look at a person as being anything but sacred. And therefore, unless they choose not to be sacred, at least you're looking at them with a smile and optimism that something good can come from that association, that exchange of energy. It's much like the people that I work with. I never ask a person about their body politic or their ideologies, religion, sexual orientation. That is irrelevant to what I'm there for, helping a person. Could you imagine if you stop before you help someone and says, by the way, before I help you, you've just had this stroke and you're in the process of dying, before I call an ambulance, are you conservative or liberal? Well, what an absurd statement. You know, you should say, this is a human being that needs help. Let me help them. Well, that's how I see the world today. Let's help people to qualify the information coming from these experts, these highly, highly opinionated, radicalized ideologies. And so that's what Richard Gale and I are going to do. We're going to deconstruct Anthony Fauci's power over the entire scientific, medical, and public health discourse, because, in my opinion, it has cost us hundreds of thousands of lives, and we will go through that. I believe that he should be challenged for his inaccuracies, and there are plenty of them. Also, Michael Kane, K-A-N-E, he's a school teacher, and he helped lead a group of school teachers who did not want to have their DNA from these COVID tests taken and used in any way. They filed a lawsuit. He won. Good for him. Good for those teachers. Now, it's a small victory, because better still would to have been able to sue to see that you would not be fired if you did not get the COVID antibody test, which is a fraudulent test, or to get the vaccine. That would be a better victory. But Robert F. Kennedy is in the process of bringing that kind of suit. So we have a lot to share today. So let us begin by looking at green tea. Now, all that I'm going to share with you now comes from the National Library of Medicine. And there are over 1,000 studies just relating to green tea and overall cancer prevention of all cancers. And I say that simply because I want you to know that I'm not giving my opinion, that there might be a skeptic in the crowd and say, well, how do we really know? Well, do what I do. Every day I'm studying the scientific literature. Every day, 7 days a week, I look at the scientific literature and I find those gems in there that don't seem to align with the mainstream media, because if you notice what I'm sharing with you, you never hear anywhere else. But it's legitimate. So here's what the FDA went to considerable efforts to publish a position paper. Quote, it is highly unlikely that green tea reduced the risk of prostate cancer, end quote. Now, this is important. Here is a completely corrupt, totally criminal organization. It should be completely disbarred. We have no use whatsoever for an FDA. It is controlled completely by policy wonks who are the Washington bureaucrats. Who'll go for major corporations like Michael Taylor going from Monsanto into the FDA and then back, then into the USDA and back. Well, we shouldn't allow anyone from a major industry that has a stake in the outcome of a decision to go into an agency of government and then to make decisions that protect or defend or help the industry that they're coming from and going back to. So when they say, well, it's highly unlikely to reduce the risk of prostate cancer, okay. So we have to rebut that. The most egregious omission was a study presented at the 96th American Association for Cancer Research meeting. These are the top oncologists, where men with premalignant prostate disease were given 600 milligrams a day. That's not a lot. You can get 250 milligram tablets. You can get 500 milligram tablets of green tea extract. Or they were given a placebo. The men taking green tea extract were 90% less likely to progress to prostate cancer compared to the placebo group after 1 year. While this study was relatively small, the FDA pretended as if it didn't happen. It did. The FDA later attacked a maker of green tea leaves that dared to state on their label, green tea may prevent prostate or breast cancer. Well, okay. So here we have a study that shows that it does. Now go 1 year forward to that, and the totality of evidence supporting a role of green tea in cancer prevention has expanded tremendously. If you enter green tea and prostate cancer in PubMed.gov database, you'll immediately see 400 published scientific studies on this specific topic. The predominance of these studies shows that green tea or its polyphenol extracts may lower prostate cancer incidence. A meta-analysis, meta means M-E-T-A, that means many different studies looking for commonalities, published in 2017, of some of these studies reveals prostate cancer risk reduction in response to higher green tea intake, meaning the more green tea you take in, the less risk of cancer. This recent meta-analysis involved a comprehensive systematic dose response review to evaluate the association of green tea intake with prostate cancer. And Then there was another meta-analysis showing that green tea and its what are called catechin polyphenols reduced the prostate cancer incidence. And so it's in study after study. In fact, one study of just looking at the polyphenol catechin from green tea, there was an associated 62% reduction in prostate cancer risk based upon three randomized controlled human trials. Is there any drug, FDA-approved drug that could do that? No. So something that is non-toxic, has no side effects that are adverse, but has positive outcome at 62% and up, that you don't want to acknowledge, then what are you afraid of? The role of the FDA was not meant to be protecting the private profits of the pharmaceutical industry. It was to promote health and safety. It has failed miserably. Now, also, there is one of 47 National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer centers located in Tampa, Florida. It conducts clinical trials related to cancer prevention and control. And Moffitt, M-O-F-F-I-T-T, is ranked as one of the top conventional, meaning mainstream orthodox cancer hospitals in the southeastern United States. A team of Moffitt researchers conducted a randomized trial to assess the safety and efficacy of green tea to prevent prostate cancer. According to the study, researchers, quote, laboratory studies have shown that substances in green tea called catechins, that's C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N-S, inhibit cancer cell growth, motility, and invasion, and stimulate cancer cell death, apoptosis, meaning it causes the cancer cells to commit suicide. Green tea catechins also prevent and reduce tumor growth in animal models. What is called EPI, galactocatechin 3 gallate, or EGCG, is the most abundant and potent catechin found in green tea, responsible for these cancer prevention effects. End quote. That's an ultra-orthodox cancer mainstream establishment scientist doing the research, and that's their conclusion. So, after 1 year, they found that it made a huge difference. And they were suggesting 200 milligrams a day. I would suggest far more than that. And then you did placebo-controlled with men receiving, and all these men had pre-malignant prostate lesions over a one-year treatment period. Overall, the differences in the number of prostate cancer cases at the end of 1 year between the two treatment groups was different. However, men who only had high-grade intraepithelial neoplasm at the beginning of the trial, there was a lower rate of progression to prostate cancer and development, and so that made a difference. Now, mind you, we're not talking about a whole complementary approach. We're talking about one single low-dose protocol. Now, I don't recommend people with cancer have such a low dose of 200 milligrams. I would start them at 600 milligrams and go up from there. You get better results. And this is actually in the scientific literature. So that's just one way of helping people who have prostate cancer. Now, mind you, there'd be a lot of other things, Africanum pygium and the soy extracts, genistein, and maitake mushrooms would also be a part of some of the things I'd be offering. And the indole-3-carbinol, I-3C, from broccoli sprouts, because these are shown to impede tumor growth, and that is important. Also with green tea, another study, this is from Chung-Buk National University School of Medicine, South Korea. EGCG in green tea inhibits the growth of breast cancer cells. These findings on breast cancer are reported by researchers at the university, and that's good news for people with breast cancer. And this is published in a mainstream peer-reviewed journal, and this was done at the university's medical school. And so that's one of the things you should know. And again, I would start at 600 milligrams. So, and then there's another study on EGCG and green tea. And this is after a lot of research. They showed that the older you are, the more beneficial the polyphenol constituents of green tea are at lowering the risk of dying from any cause. Yes, this is a longevity benefit for older people. Green tea combats many underlying processes that contribute to premature aging and disease. And I took a careful look at this study, and this was looking at the cohort studies, and it showed that the outcome was positive. The more green tea that you drink, the more reduced your risk of dying from anything you would normally die from. So that's good. This one study, the largest individual study involving populations of 40,000 to 160,000 people, that's a big study. All-cause mortality risk, quote, reduced 11 to 18% in those drinking the largest daily amounts of green tea, five or more cups, compared to non-green tea drinkers. And these studies also found that more tea consumption people, the greater the reduction in risk. And another study of 14,000 older adults found a still more impressive overall risk reduction of 58% in the highest consumption group. And women, it was 68%. And finally, a meta-analysis pulling the results of 18 individual cohort studies found a 20% reduction in all causes of death in the highest group of consuming green tea. It helps with cardiovascular disease, and it helps with diabetes. It helps with neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And because EGCG can prevent Alzheimer's disease by reducing production of the toxic protein called beta amyloid, as well as resulting inflammation, turns off inflammation, otherwise will destroy brain cells. And of course, it does a great job against cancer. So that's the latest work on green tea, very important. Just like taurine, something inexpensive, easy to find, non-toxic, and you have all those studies. Mind you, 400 just on prostate cancer, thousands of studies overall, and yet you would never know this if you spoke with anyone from the FDA. I remember once I contacted someone at the FDA. I was going to go down to Mexico to look at an alternative cancer therapy I was told exists down there by a patient. And the man said, quote, oh, you're wasting your time. All you're going to find in Mexico with cancer clinics are dirt floor hovels with no one trained in oncology. That's what he said. Okay, fine. So I went down there. So I'm looking around, and I can't find any of these places, but I did see this tall building, and so I went in, the brand new modern building, and I look up and hear all these names, like 50 oncologists' names in their departments and radiology, etc. And I told the receptionist I was there, could I speak with the manager or whoever ran the place? And he was out at that moment, so I said, would you mind if I just walk around? He said, no, walk around. The very first person whose room I went into was a woman from India, and she was herself a physician, and she had terminal cancer. She had been there for 3 months, and she was no longer terminal. The therapy doctor, she was helping some of the other patients understand the natures of the therapies, and she said, this is just a remarkable place. Who knew it existed? But how is it that a federal agency like the Food and Drug Administration wouldn't know that there are legitimate clinics around the world using a combination of orthodox and alternative therapies, mainly alternative therapies, but they had an operating theater. They had everything there. So just be aware, the FDA is not the best source of information. We're 20 minutes into our program, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to go to three separate videos. We're not going to play all of them. But when someone says, well, how do I know that this approach to COVID might work? Well, there are now hundreds of physicians in the United States using ivermectin, I-V-E-R-M-E-C-T-I-N. And zinc, and an antibiotic. Just as there are thousands of doctors, if they can get it, using hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and an antibiotic. This is some testimony under oath by these are mainstream orthodox board-certified physicians, also professor of medicine, who are telling you this, not me. So I'm suggesting that you get this information, so if you choose to do something preventatively, since we have so many nurses and doctors, or if you start getting symptoms and you start taking these drugs, your life could be saved. Yet Anthony Fauci won't support this, nor the FDA, nor the AMA, nor any of our medical organizations, but they'll support any drug, even though the drugs that they're coming out with have been shown not to work against COVID, that they support. But this, they don't. So we'll be back, and you're going to hear three separate physicians giving insight. These are all board-certified, mainstream, pro-vaccine physicians. Now, so on all other issues of medicine, they're going to be in alignment. But on approaching COVID, they're not. Back. Please listen.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ryder. Our next witness is here in person, Dr. Pierre Corey. Dr. Corey is the former associate professor and chief of the critical care service and medical director of the Trauma and Life Support Center at the University of Wisconsin, and recently joined the ICU service at Aurora St. Luke Medical Center in Milwaukee. He is board certified in critical medicine, pulmonary diseases, and internal medicine. Dr. Corey has traveled across multiple states in the U.S. to care for COVID-19 patients throughout the pandemic. He is also the president of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, a nonprofit organization of critical care specialists led by Professor Paul Merrick, whose mission over the last 9 months has focused on the research and development of effective treatment protocols for COVID-19 using repurposed drugs. He received his MD from St. George's University School of Medicine, and I'll only add that we added Dr. Corey very late to our hearing in May, because I'd heard of his development of, anti-inflammatory steroids in critical care on COVID. And Dr. Corey, I have to tell you, I've had doctors come up to me and thank me for holding that hearing where they listened to you, change their thinking. They believe they've saved their patients' lives because of your testimony at that hearing. I hope your testimony will be as impactful today. Dr. Corey.
Senator, thank you, and thank you for holding this hearing. I just want to start out, I didn't think I'd have to say this, but I want to register my offense at the ranking member's opening statement. I was discredited as a politician. I am a physician and a man of science. I have done nothing but commit myself to scientific truth and the care of patients. And to hear that I'm here because of a political angle, I am not a politician, I'm a physician. I want to start out by saying that I'm not speaking as an individual, I'm speaking on behalf of the organization that I'm a part of. We are a group of some of the most highly published physicians in the world. We have near 2,000 peer-reviewed publications among us, led by Professor Paul Merrick, who's our intellectual leader. We came together early on in the pandemic, and all we have sought is to review the world's literature on every facet of this disease, trying to develop effective protocols. You just mentioned that I was here in May, and I recommended that it was critical that we use corticosteroids in this disease when all of the national and international healthcare organizations said we cannot use those. That turned out to be a life-saving recommendation. I am here again today with a new recommendation. In the last 9 months, in our review of all of the literature as a group, again, we are some of the most highly published physicians in our specialty and the world. We have done nothing but try to figure out how to identify a repurposed and available drug to treat this illness. We have now come to the conclusion after 9 months, and I have to point out, I am severely troubled by the fact that the NIH, the FDA, and the CDC, I do not know of any task force that was assigned or compiled to review repurposed drugs in an attempt to treat this disease. Everything has been about novel and or expensive pharmaceutically engineered drugs, things like tocilizumab and remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies and vaccines. We have 100 years of medicine development. We know we are expert in all the medicines we use, and I do not know of a task force that has been focused on repurposed drugs. I will tell you that my group and our organization, I will say that we have filled that void. That is all we have done is focus on the things we know and things we do. And I'm here to tell you, Dr. Ryder, he just presented. He has one study of the many that I want to talk about. And I want to talk about that we have a solution to this crisis. There is a drug that is proving to be of miraculous impact. And when I say miracle, I do not use that term lightly. And I don't want to be sensationalized when I say that. That is a scientific recommendation based on mountains of data that has emerged in the last 3 months. When I am told, and I just had to hear this in the opening sentence, that we are touting things that are not FDA or NIH recommended, let me be clear. The NIH, their recommendation on ivermectin, which is to not use it outside of controlled trials, is from August 27th. We are now in December. This is 3 to 4 months later. Mountains of data have emerged from many centers and countries around the world showing the miraculous effectiveness of ivermectin. It basically obliterates transmission of this virus. If you take it, you will not get sick. I want to briefly summarize the data. My manuscript, again, published by some of the most, we have contributed more to the medical knowledge of our specialty in our careers than anyone else can claim as a group. And our manuscript, which was posted on Medicine Preprint Server, details all of this evidence. I want to briefly summarize it. Number one, we have evidence that ivermectin is effective not only in prophylaxis, in the prevention. If you take it, you will not get sick. We just came across a trial last night from Argentina by the lead investigator of ivermectin in Argentina, Dr. Hector Carvalho. They prophylaxed 800 healthcare workers. Not one got sick. In the 400 that they didn't prophylax with ivermectin, 58% got sick. 237 of those 400 got sick. If you take it, you will not get sick. It has immense and potent antiviral activity. We know that from the first study in Monash, it has made the bench to the bedside. Prophylaxis, we now have 4 large randomized controlled trials totaling over 1,500 patients, each trial showing that as a prophylaxis agent, it is immensely effective. You will not get sick. You will be protected from getting ill if you take it. In early outpatient treatment, we have 3 randomized controlled trials and multiple observation as well as case series showing that if you take ivermectin, the need for hospitalization and death will decrease. The most profound evidence we have is in the hospitalized patients. We have 4 randomized controlled trials there, multiple observation trials, all showing the same thing. You will not die, or you will die at much, much, much lower rates. Statistically significant, large magnitude results if you take ivermectin. It is proving to be a wonder drug. It has already won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2015 for its impacts on global health in the eradication of parasitic diseases. It is proving to be an immensely powerful antiviral and anti-inflammatory agent. It is critical for its use in this disease. We, again, stand by our manuscript. It is a scientific manuscript. It's been submitted for peer review. But please recognize, peer review takes time. It takes months. We do not have months. We have 100,000 patients in the hospital right now dying. I'm a lung specialist. I'm an ICU specialist. I've cared for more dying COVID patients than anyone can imagine. They're dying because they can't breathe. They can't breathe. They're on high-flow oxygen delivery devices. They're on non-invasive ventilators and or they're sedated and paralyzed and attached to mechanical ventilators that breathe for them. And I watch them every day. They die. By the time they get me in the ICU, they're already dying. They're almost impossible to recover. Early treatment is key. We need to offload the hospitals. We are tired. I can't keep doing this. If you look at my manuscript, and if I have to go back to work next week, any further deaths are going to be needless deaths, and I cannot be traumatized by that. I cannot keep caring for patients when I know that they could have been saved with earlier treatment, and that drug that will treat them and prevent the hospitalization is ivermectin. I am here today. I'm calling to action. The NIH, their last recommendation was August 27th. August 27th. I want to be clear. I am not here as a politician or a dramatist or sensationalizing what I'm recommending. I am going to be very clear and very simple. All I ask is for the NIH to review our data that we've compiled of all of the emerging data. We have almost...
Ivermectin is an FDA-approved medication for parasitic infections. Ivermectin is widely available due to its inclusion on the WHO model list of essential medicines. It opens glutamate-sensitive chloride channel currents in helminths, and it's widely believed that this is how it kills certain parasites. It's the drug of choice for the treatment of onchocerciasis and strongyloidiasis, both of which are parasitic infections. Ivermectin is effective against several intestinal nematodes, including ascariasis, trichoriasis, and also cutaneous larva migrans, also Wuchereria bancrofti, Brugia malayi, Mansonella azardi, and Loa Loa. It also is effective against scabies and head lice. So why might ivermectin work against SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes COVID-19? Well, once the virus gains entry into the cells of the body using the ACE2 receptor, the virus releases its messenger RNA into the cell. The cell starts to translate the messenger RNA from the virus, which starts to make viral proteins, and that's how new virus forms. But some of these viral proteins that are freshly made then enter into the nucleus of the cell, or at least are thought to do so by many scientists. And this probably impairs our cell's ability to fight off the infection. The way these viral proteins are thought to gain entry into the nucleus of our cells is through specific channels that are made out of a different protein called importin. Not important, it's importin. There's importin type alpha and type beta, or IMP alpha and IMP beta for short. And this is where ivermectin comes in, because ivermectin inhibits the passage of these viral proteins into the nucleus. It does so by binding to these protein channels and effectively blocking the transport of molecules through them. So this is why scientists started studying ivermectin. And here we have this article that just came out April 3rd in the journal Antiviral Research. This is a pre-proof article, meaning they've been peer-reviewed, but final publication is still pending. What these scientists found is that ivermectin significantly inhibits the SARS-2 coronavirus viral proteins in their passage from the cytoplasm into the nucleus of the cells in vitro. In vitro means this was done in a test tube or outside of a living organism. So a single dose of ivermectin had a 5,000-fold reduction in virus levels at 48 hours in cell culture. So this drug has a huge impact on this virus in vitro.
Now for our last one.
And welcome to another edition of Your Health with Dr. Christy. My name is Dr. Christy Reisinger, and today we're going to continue to talk about ivermectin. To my shock and dismay, the previous video I published on December 22nd about ivermectin was taken down by YouTube. But because I think this information is important, I'm again publishing a video about ivermectin. But I want to clearly state that I am not recommending that anyone take ivermectin at this point. I'm simply giving people data and information about the studies that are available now to allow the public to understand more about this medication, and with the hopes that they will sign a petition imploring the NIH and WHO to review the emerging evidence regarding ivermectin in order to give updated guidance to physicians. After hearing the evidence, if you would like to sign the petition, please see the link below in the description. Ivermectin has been gaining popularity both as a preventative treatment for COVID-19 and also as an immediate treatment after exposure to COVID-19. There's also been some studies about using it during admission in the hospital, but I'm going to focus today's edition just on using ivermectin for prevention or prophylaxis against COVID-19. I first heard about using ivermectin in these capacities based on the work from Dr. Paul Merrick at the Eastern Virginia Medical School. I used some of this data on a prior video when I discussed using vitamins to possibly prevent COVID-19. Today, we're going to focus specifically on ivermectin and the possible prevention of COVID-19. After looking at the data on ivermectin, I'm excited and encouraged by some of the data I've seen. But once again, I want to state that I'm not advocating its use at this time. I'm advocating that the NIH and WHO use its influence and power to look at the data that's available to provide guidance to physicians. Ivermectin has traditionally been used for over 40 years as an antiparasitic. but it's also known to have antiviral properties as well. A study from June 2020 showed effectiveness in the lab in the reduction of SARS-CoV-2 virus in ivermectin-treated cells compared to control samples, indicating that ivermectin treatment resulted in the elimination of all evidence of SARS-CoV-2 virus by 48 hours. But let's move out of the lab and talk about studies in humans. The first study that really caught my eye was out of Argentina. This study first started by using a combination of topical nasal carrageenan, which is a natural thickening agent used in foods, and oral ivermectin drops to see if they would reduce SARS-CoV-2 infection in healthcare workers. Combination therapy of ivermectin and carrageenan, called Ivacar, consisted of sprays of topical carrageenan into the nose and mouth, followed 5 minutes later by drops of ivermectin onto the tongue. This dosage schedule was repeated multiple times a day for 14 days. And a total of 229 health personnel were recruited for this study. 98 were within the control and used PPE alone, and 131 received Ivacar treatment in addition to their wearing of PPE. None of the health personnel treated with Ivacar tested positive for COVID-19 during the 14-day treatment period, and none had positive swabs for COVID-19 in the 3 weeks post-completion of their initial treatment. This was compared to 11 health personnel that tested positive for COVID-19 during the study period. Now, I wasn't sure what to do with this data since I don't have familiarity with carrageenan or oral ivermectin drops, but as I read on, I realized they also did a second part to their study. In the second part of the study, a total of 1,195 healthcare workers were recruited from 4 major hospitals in Argentina. And they changed the protocol so that the study arm used oral carrageenan and ivermectin tablets given at a dose of 12 milligrams once per week. At the end of the study, none of the 788 volunteers treated with Ivacar tested positive for COVID-19 during the 3-month study period. But 58.2%, or 237 of 407 in the PPE-only control group, tested positive for COVID-19. I think these results are...
Okay. I have at least 40 different testimonials by board-certified mainstream Orthodox physicians about ivermectin. Today, I received the latest one from a doctor's Farid and Tyson testifying before Congress, and they gave their protocols. They used 200 milligrams. This is for all of our healthcare workers in the audience. 200 milligrams of hydroxychloroquine and zinc sulfate at 50 milligrams zinc of elemental zinc, and azithromycin 500 milligrams, and also a doxycycline. So they have the, and also they're using ivermectin at 3 milligrams. And it says get it in the first 4 days for really phenomenal results. So what I'm doing is this. I've given you at least 215 studies from the peer-reviewed literature on hydroxychloroquine working. I'm showing you all the studies on ivermectin working. Every day we try to provide positive insights so that we can make more informed choices. And one of the issues we're faced with today is we don't know who to believe. We don't know who's got the correct information. Should we just wait and get our vaccination from Anthony Fauci? Should we all line up to take the antibody test, the PCR test? Should we take some of the older and proven drugs hydroxychloroquine, for example? Or should we wait till one of the new miracle drugs that Anthony Fauci has been funding comes out? What should we accept? What should we reject? So we're in kind of in a conundrum with that. And I really respect Chris Hedges. He, along with Abby Martin and Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report and others, have had the courage to come forward and just to tell us the truth. It's not meant to anger us or incite us. It's meant to awaken us. And I believe at this time, ending one of the worst years in all of our lives, we have to, you know, take that bitter pill and say, okay, what is it we need to know? Well, the ruling elites are painfully aware, according to Chris Hedges, that the foundations of American power are rotting. The outsourcing of manufacturing in the United States and the plunging of over half the population into poverty will, they know, not be reversed. No matter what any politician tells you, no matter what Biden and his whole cabinet say, no matter what the New York Times, Washington Post says, or Fox says, most people will be on some form of emotional or financial or physical life support because of what has occurred with mismanaging this crisis. But this was happening long before COVID. A few weeks before COVID, I saw how bad it was. And I gave you the unemployment numbers, the real unemployment numbers, you know, that we were about 24% unemployed, not the official 3.6% government made up unemployment numbers. And I told you how much in debt we were. I just updated that just this week, and at over $240 trillion. So much that we will never be able to pay it. So why are we telling the world that we're the example they should follow? We're not. So we have plunged over 165 million Americans into abject poverty to the degree that they will never get out of it for the rest of their lives, especially the young people who deserve a life. This is not by accident. This is intent. That's what greed does. The self-destructive government shutdown has been only one of numerous assaults on the efficacy of the administration state. The failing roads, the bridges, the public transportation are making commerce and communications more difficult. The soaring government deficit. Now it's trillions of dollars more because of the Trump administration's massive and in my opinion, completely unneeded corporate tax cuts. They cannot be eliminated. But think of that for a moment. Think how easy it was to sell the American public on the idea that we needed a tax cut for the rich, that money would trickle down. It has never trickled down. That's a completely false narrative. The people bought up their own stock in their companies, and as a result, with fewer outstanding shares of stock, the value of the existing stock increased. So they used taxpayer, in effect, money to help strengthen their financial position in their own companies. They bought up competition. Monopolies became super monopolies, Nova monopolies. The reality is that you and I, we have to pay our taxes. Wealthy corporations, wealthy people pay very little or no taxes. So what if we just had one tax plan? Every corporation in America, from small businesses to major monolithic corporations, must pay 20% of their income in taxes. That would be fair. That would allow us then to stop seeing the offshoring of massive amounts of what should be taxable income. Forgive all that. Give them a forgiveness. They can repatriate all that trillions of dollars corporations collectively have in Ireland and the Bahamas and Cayman Islands, and they pay a 20% tax on all that. That would bring trillions of dollars back into the American treasury. But it won't happen. Why? Because the seizure of the financial system by global speculators ensures, sooner rather than later, another financial meltdown. The dysfunction of the democratic institutions, which vomit up con artists such as Donald Trump and hold as alternatives inept corporate indentured politicians such as Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, is cementing into place a new authoritarianism. The hollowing out of the pillars of the state, including the diplomatic corps and regulatory agencies, leaves the blunt force of the military as the only response to foreign disputes and fuels endless and futile foreign wars. Just as ominous as the visible rot is the internal decay. Among all social classes, there is a loss of faith in the government. Rightly so. Widespread frustration, a sense of stagnation and entrapment, bitterness over unfulfilled expectations and promises, and a merging of fact and fiction so that civil and political discourse is no longer rooted in reality. The nation's isolation by its traditional allies and its inability, especially in the face of environmental catastrophe, to articulate rational and visionary policies have shattered the mystique that is so vital to power. It was George Orwell who said a society becomes totalitarian when its structure becomes flagrantly artificial. That is, when its ruling class has lost its function but succeeds in clinging to power by force or fraud. Our elites have exhausted fraud. Force is all that may have been left behind. The United States is a wounded beast, bellowing and thrashing in this death throes. It can inflict tremendous damage, but it cannot recover. These are the last agonizing days of the American empire. The death blow will come when the dollar is dropped as the world's reserve currency, a process already underway. The value of the dollar will plummet, setting off a severe depression and demanding instant contraction of the military overseas. Seth Klarman, who runs the BOPOS Group hedge fund, which manages about $27 billion, just sent a sobering 22-page letter to his investors. He pointed out that the nation's ratio of government debt to gross domestic product was in excess from 2008 to 2017, exceed 100%, and is close to that of France, Canada, Britain, and Spain. Just this week, I presented information showing that it's 1,100%. 1,100%. We are completely bankrupt. What happens then when China continues with its Silk Road over on the ocean and in land, connecting already with 70 different countries willing to work with it in partnership with massive trade agreements? And they're building seaports, they're building roads, they're building infrastructure at an amazingly fast rate. China, after all, was able to build a skyscraper from beginning to end, from breaking the ground till it's finished, in under 3 weeks. It takes us 3 years. So they will jump ahead of us in the very near future. When that happens, and they have their yuan attached to gold, we have no gold, and we have a fiat currency. The dollar will collapse, and suddenly everyone who has equity in money, they will suddenly find themselves a lot poorer. The ruling elites, worried about impending financial collapse, are scrambling to cement into place harsh legal and physical forms of control to stymie what they fear could be widespread popular unrest, nascent forms of which can be seen in strikes carried out by American teachers and protesters. For example, the Yellow Vest protesters in France. The rooting ideology of neoliberalism, both left and right, the ruling elites recognize has been discredited across the political spectrum. This is forcing the elites to make unsavory alliances with neo-fascists, who in the United States are represented by the Christian right. This Christianized fascism is swiftly filling Trump's, and now it'll be Biden's, ideological void. In conclusion, in its most virulent form, one that will be expressed once the economy goes into crisis, this Christian fascism will seek to purge the society of those branded as social deviants, including immigrants, Muslims, secular humanists, artists, intellectuals, feminists, gays, lesbians, Native Americans, and criminals, largely poor people of color based on a perverted and heretical interpretation of the Bible. So we're in for rough times. How rough? Nobody knows. I can't predict that. I can just simply say that I agree with Chris Hedges. I agree with the other people who are saying we are in the final death throes of our empire. But from that may emerge a more powerful and harmonized and peaceful and progressive society. Now let's go over and say hello to Michael Caine. Hi, Michael. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, Gary. Happy New Year to you and everyone listening.
Good. Real quick, right to the point, tell us about your victory and what it means.
Well, I want to thank you, Gary, for back in September having us on the show when no one was listening to us. The New York City schools are forcing COVID testing on teachers and on students. And I had a simple question of, is my specimen protected, or can the company that's taking my specimen, one of them is Fulgent Genetics, who owns a genetic library, can they use it for profit? No one would answer us. Hundreds of teachers and students called and emailed the DOE, de Blasio, the head of schools, the head of our union. No answers at all. But when we got a lawyer, and when we got Michael Sussman, a Harvard-trained legendary civil rights attorney, to represent us, they started writing letters back. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get everything we needed until we brought them to court. And we brought them to court, and we were able to get a court-ordered stipulation that states in plain English, our specimens cannot be used by any vendor or any person in any way other than obtaining a COVID positive or negative test. So this is a victory. It's a small victory. You can read all about it at our website, nyteachersforchoice.org. No numbers in that, all letters, nyteachersforchoice.org. But it is important that we challenge what is happening in this system, because President Biden has now said he's entertaining every single student and teacher in the country will need to be tested in the public schools. So that's the next thing we're dealing with. And thankfully, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Mary Holland, and the good people at Children's Health Defense, along with a Long Island attorney named Jim Mermigas, also Ray Flores is on this case, they are challenging a much broader challenge than what we just won in the courts. They are challenging the entire COVID testing regime as being immoral, illegal, and unscientific, and they're going directly at challenging, amongst other things, challenging the PCR tests that are being used. And Gary, as you know, you've talked about this at length here on the show, the PCR tests are no gold standard, even though the CDC says they are. They are substandard at best. So everybody needs to watch that case. That case is called Avilis versus de Blasio. You can find out more about that at the Children's Health Defense website or at New York Teachers for Choice. We are covering that case closely as well, too.
Michael, we'll have you back on when next week, Robert F. Kennedy is going to do a Zoom press conference announcing that lawsuit. Our goal is to see that no teacher in the United States is forced to take a flawed and fraudulent PCR test and then to be vaccinated or excluded if they're not vaccinated from being able to teach. Thank you very much, Michael. We're out of time. Everyone, thank you for listening. I'll be on tomorrow. Have a lot to share. Have a nice day.